Professor Noakes, waarom het jy jou denkrigting oor die eet verander? Jy was aan die een wat aan langafstand atlete aanbeveel het om die aand voordat hulle hardloop 'n klomp koolhidrate te eet. Met ander woorde, die hele konsep van carb loading. En nou beweeg jy totaal weg daarvan af.
Well, I think the reason why I changed was I was so sick and I didn't realize it. I thought I was just getting old. And just by chance, I saw an advert on the internet on my email saying lose 6 kilograms in 6 weeks without hunger by following the particular Atkins diet. And I said, but Atkins was the killer. He made us eat fat and he killed the whole of America and the whole world, you see. So I thought, there's no way I'm going to follow the Atkins diet to lose weight because I felt that the time had arrived that I needed to lose some weight. And then I noticed the three authors, Westman, Volek and Finney. I said, but hold on, these are three serious scientists. Why would they be linking their credibility to a completely incredible person like Atkins? And I was sufficiently inspired that I went down to Exclusive Books, and within 10 minutes I'd bought the book, and I brought it home, and within an hour I read. It said, there are 150 studies showing the benefits of a low-carbohydrate diet. And I said, but hold on, I'm a biologist, I'm a medical doctor, I've never, ever heard of these studies. I knew they'd done studies of athletes, but I didn't know they'd done studies of health effects of low-carbohydrate diets. And I said, it's astonishing. And the evidence is all here, and it's been suppressed or hidden. So I said, I'm going to try it. And I haven't eaten much carbohydrate since that moment. The health benefits were utterly, utterly astonishing for me. And for the first year, I didn't tell anyone, but they could see because I'd lost so much weight. Then, of course, they would start asking. And then the English media got after me, and they asked some questions. And then everyone became interested. And then there was a television program with Derek Watts. And that caused a huge furor, as you can imagine. Everyone said, Noakes is now promoting a high-fat diet, and the fat's going to cause our cholesterol to go up, and we're all going to die, etc.
Waarom het jy die onwetenskaplike roete gevolg om 'n boek vir die algemene publiek te skryf, pleks van om navorsingsartikels in 'n mediese joernaal of 'n vaktydskrif te publiseer?
Well, that's a great question. You see, the reality is all the science has been done. It is there. Dr. Volek, Finney, and Westman did the work. And there's a recent book out by Nina Teichold called The Big Fat Surprise, in which she completely obliterates the diet heart theory. She goes back to the 1930s and 40s and 50s particularly and looks at the evidence that has been proposed to support the idea of must eat a low-fat diet. She says the evidence is not there. The science is appalling. And what happened was one man's opinion, Ansel Keys, became the dominant theme. And industry got behind it, and the U.S. government got behind it, and all the funding agencies in the U.S. got behind it. So the whole government in the U.S. got behind this idea that a low-fat diet was healthy, and they promoted it. And anything that conflicted that was hidden. And so when I read that book, I realized that this evidence has been hidden. It is out there. There are clinical trials showing that if you go on a high-fat diet, you reduce all your risk factors for heart disease, every single one. Whereas if you eat a high carbohydrate diet, and if you're like me, insulin resistant, you worsen all your coronary risk factors. So you have to ask, if the evidence is so clear, why were we not told? And Nina Teichold in her book shows why it was hidden. It was the US government made an error. They took information that was not complete. There was no scientific trial ever on a low-fat diet. There was no clinical evidence that low-fat diets make us healthy. They brought out this global change. Unfortunately, because we're English speakers and we respect the Americans, we followed. Thank goodness some countries didn't follow, like France and Switzerland and Germany. So they're much healthier than the rest of us because they didn't change their diet. And the countries that changed their diets have had this wave of obesity and diabetes. So what Nina Teichold shows is that there was absolutely no evidence for change. When I read what Westman and Volek and Finney had done, and I read all the evidence that this is a global movement, it's not Tim Noakes, it is a global movement, very strong in Sweden, growing in United States, growing in New Zealand, growing in Australia, of doctors who realize that we have been completely misled. And the reason why the population is unhealthy is because they're simply eating too much cheap carbohydrate and addictive sugars. So your question is very valid. Why have the studies not been done by me before I went public with this book? We should never have changed in 1972 and 77. Because the point is, you have to eat. You have to eat each day. You can't avoid it. And you must look for the best evidence. There will never be a perfect diet trial. It is impossible. Because you have to take people and put them in a jail and for 40 years feed them every day and control exactly what they do. That is the only way you can work out whether it's the diet that causes the ill health or it's something else. You cannot do diet studies in free-living humans. And all the studies that have been done in free-living humans. But guess what? There have been three major trials of low-fat diets costing in excess of $2 billion. Not one of them has shown any benefit whatsoever. And in fact, some show harm. Because once you take fat out the diet, you replace it with carbohydrate and sugar, and that produces a whole stream of other problems. So a lot of people criticize me for not doing the science first. The answer is the science is out there. And I'm very happy to take that criticism, but I would like people to be open enough to say, okay, fine, if this is what they believe, there's no evidence for the low carbohydrate diet. I want them to say, but what's the quality of evidence for the low fat diet? And the answer is, it is of no quality. And Nina Teichel's work proves that absolutely, to the point. Harvard Medical School comes out and said, we got the low-fat story wrong. There are three major reports of all the studies combined saying we got it wrong. Fat is not the cause of heart disease. Now, either we as South Africans say, we are different and we don't have to listen to the rest of the world. And we're going to carry on telling people incorrectly that fat causes heart disease and fat makes us unhealthy and fat makes us fat. Or we're going to open our minds and save the nation by saying, actually, there's no evidence for that. Let's rather look at the evidence that if we cut our carbohydrates, we'd be a whole lot healthier.
Het dinge nie verkeerd geloop, omdat mense, pleks van om minder vette te eet, het hulle net boonbehalwe wat hulle alles eet, net meer en meer koolhidrate geëet nie. Het dit nie gemaak dat hulle totale aantal kilojoules net meer en meer geword het en dat dit tot die vetsug epidemie gelei het nie.
The obesity pandemic is caused directly by the food processed food industry because what they learned was if you take fat out the diet, it tastes like nothing. Food tastes like cardboard if you take fat out of it. So they soon learned that if you added sugar, sugar is highly addictive. So instead of selling you 100 grams of carbohydrate, they could get you to eat 200 grams of carbohydrate. So that was the addictive sugar component. But there's another component that carbohydrates do not satiate. Carbohydrates make you hungry. So you're quite right that if you're eating a high carbohydrate diet, you will eat more calories than you need to. And that has been shown since the 1970s. So this was the unintended consequences. They said, if we take fat out the diet, we'll have no more heart disease and we'll have no more obesity. Because the model was too simplistic. They didn't understand you have a brain. And the brain determines what you eat and how much you eat. And they didn't understand that fat and protein suppress hunger and sugar and carbohydrates stimulate hunger. So from that moment that those guidelines came up, obesity went rampant throughout the world. We know obesity starts in 1980, not in 1970, not in 1960, in 1980, 3 years after the guidelines come out. And no one, but no one will say, gee whiz, maybe we got it wrong. So what they say now is actually we weren't wrong. The people were wrong. The people were lazy. They suddenly become lazy overnight. In 1980, we went from a population that was vigorous, athletic, and lean to one that was lazy, and all they wanted to eat was for this foods. And then no one made the point that it's the food that is the problem. That was the first point. The second point is that humans differ in their ability to metabolize carbohydrate. And we call that insulin resistance or carbohydrate resistance or intolerance. And it turns out, in my view, that about 70% of populations are insulin resistant. And there must be some biological reason for that. In our evolution, being insulin resistant must have allowed us to survive better. And the explanation would be simple. If you were eating a high-fat, high-protein diet, you need to be insulin resistant to survive if you've got no carbohydrates. And so the reality is that we've got these large populations who are insulin resistant, and the one thing they can't eat is carbohydrate. And then all of a sudden in 1977, we come along and say, eat lots of carbohydrate. So that overwhelms the body. And the biology is very, very simple. If you have insulin resistance, you will become fat, you will develop diabetes, you will develop obesity, you will develop high blood pressure, you will develop gout, And probably dementia and cancer are also linked. It's all there in the literature if you put it together. But because there's been this huge error that we've made, no one is prepared to change. And sadly, it wasn't medicine that made the error. It was the US government that made the error. And they will never admit the error. You know, the Minister of Health said that we should stop arguing, we should just give proper advice. Well, the reality is, we have been giving advice to South Africans, and they've got fatter. So surely the conclusion is that the advice is wrong. But we don't say that. We say the patients are wrong. But they aren't. If you have insulin resistant, you will become fat eating carbohydrate because it's a protective mechanism. And until you cut the carbohydrates, you will not have the brain controls to reduce your calories and allow you to lose weight. So until we change the advice, we've got to debate it, and we've got to argue, and we've got to hit heads together, because what we're doing now is killing the nation. It is bankrupting our health services. We either find out what causes obesity and diabetes and dementia, or else we just build more hospitals and train more doctors to give ineffective drugs for diseases that the causes of which are known, but because we're too scared to admit it, we won't say, actually, we were wrong. And I'm the first guy who had the courage to say, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I apologize. And I'm changed because I read the literature and it's all there. And until we get this vigorous debate going. So what's happened is I get demonized. They say I lost my mind. Well, that's ludicrous because I've got more evidence on my side than others have on their sides.
Professor Nous, kan jy verduidelik hoe dit werk as jy sê dat die vet in jou dieet het niks met jou bloedvatgesondheid te doen nie? Kan jy die biochemie verduidelik? As verhoogde cholesterolvlakke niks met hartaanvalle te doen het nie, hoe verklaar jy dat iemand met familiële hypercholesterolemie met baie hoë bloedcholesterolvlakke op 'n baie vroeë ouderdom reeds verstopte bloedvate het en reeds op 20 of 30 of in sy vroeë 40 'n hartaanval kan kry?
Well, if we go back to the Framingham study, which is the one that really gets the theory of cholesterol and heart disease going, all the Framingham study showed in the initial study was that for men under the age of 55, there was a link between the cholesterol level in the blood and their risk of heart attack. When they went back 30 years later, they had to revise that, and they found that for people over that age, there was no relationship, and in women, there was never a relationship shown. So if you look at the biological evidence in normal people without FH, the evidence that they presented was that for men under 55, there was a linkage, but in no other group there was. We now know, for example, at my advanced age of 65, essentially the higher cholesterols are healthier, and the same with women. At our advanced age of over 60, higher cholesterols are protective against dementia and cancer. But we're not told that, whereas a low cholesterol predicts risk of dementia and cancer. So that was the first evidence. Then you see, when they brought Framingham data out, and then it became stated that your LDL cholesterol predicts heart attack risk, the next thing was to produce drugs that lowered it. And the initial studies of drugs that lowered cholesterol found no effect on mortality at all. And only when they produced the statin drugs in the 1980s did they finally have a drug which reduced cholesterol and reduced heart attack rates marginally in healthy people, but did not in fact impact on all-cause mortality. So a person with a raised cholesterol taking a statin dies on the same day that they always would have, but the diagnosis is different. It may not be heart attack, it could be cancer or something else. But all-cause mortality has not changed. And in addition, you have to treat 140 patients for one to benefit. So the drugs are essentially ineffective. But unfortunately, industry got behind it and drove it. And medical students are not told that. Medical students don't understand statistics and what probability means and what risk is. They are told that cholesterol-lowering drugs significantly reduce heart attack risk, which is true. If you take 1 million people, there will be a significant reduction. But for the individual, the effect is almost negligible. And that's what we're not told. Right. So if a drug is so effective in lowering cholesterol and is so ineffective in changing heart attack rates, you have to ask, hold on, maybe cholesterol is not such a good predictor of heart attack risk. And that is continually shown There is not one single study in the scientific literature which has directly linked the level of the cholesterol in the bloodstream and the damage to your arteries. And there's a paper out 4 months ago by Dr. Creakey in the Journal of American Medical Association where they look at the calcium content of the arteries of the heart, the coronary artery calcium volume, and they show that that is the best predictor of future heart attack risk. So if you have a high CAC volume, you are at a six-fold increased risk of heart attack. There is nothing else we can measure in a human that will tell us better what your risk of a future heart attack is. You can forget cholesterol. Cholesterol is essentially useless in predicting. Then you look at the data, and it turns out that people with high CAC scores, in other words, with a six-fold increased risk of heart attack, had no higher cholesterol than those people with no increased risk. The calcium CAC volume is measured in a scan, so you need to go and have it scanned. And I tell patients now who are really worried, who have a high cholesterol, for example, that you must treat your CAC score. And if you've got a high CAC score, then I'd be concerned. Now, come back to your point about FH. It turns out that there are many people with FH who do not get heart disease, but they missed because they're not seen in the population. And in my opinion, genetic hypercholesterolemia may have many other factors associated, maybe other genetic abnormalities that cause the risk. And we do know what really increases your risk of heart attack is not your cholesterol, it's the oxidized cholesterol. And it may well be that people with familial hypercholesterolemia also have very high oxidized cholesterol. But to go and take them as the example of how we treat other patients and explain the disease to other patients is wrong. I might just add there's another paper in the Journal of American Medical Association in the last 2 months showing that 85% of Americans with heart attacks have normal cholesterol levels. So having a normal cholesterol level does not tell you you're not going to have a heart attack. And people are not told this. In the 1990s, a chap called Fred Kummerow, who today is 99 and still researching, showed he took arteries from sick people who had died and looked at them. And he showed that the cholesterol did not predict the extent of damage of the arteries, but the oxidized cholesterol in the bloodstream did. And he showed that the oxidized cholesterol elevates the content of sphingomyelin in the arteries, and the sphingomyelin causes calcium to enter the artery plaque and cause damage. So if we were really questioning and just didn't accept, we would be saying, okay, why do coronary arteries increase their sphingomyelin content and their calcium content? And it's clearly not just due to cholesterol, it's due to something else. And his opinion is that it's the oxidized cholesterol, which is related to diet and high carbohydrate diets, diabetic patients, high vegetable oil diets, diets that are low in vitamin B6, and probably other vitamins as well. So in other words, nutrient-poor diets are probably as much to blame for heart disease, coronary artery disease, as the fat in the diet. And finally, I want to make the point that you make cholesterol in the body from both fat and carbohydrate. And if you're on a high carbohydrate diet, you will produce cholesterol from carbohydrate. The simplistic idea that you eat saturated fat and somehow it just ends up in your arteries is so simplistic, it's stupid. Because when you eat saturated fat or fat in the diet, it is broken down and it is transported to your muscles and your fat cells where it is stored, not as cholesterol, as triglycerides. Those triglycerides are then released when you need them for fuel, and the excess triglyceride goes to the liver where it's combined with cholesterol, which is made in the liver from either fat or carbohydrate, and that produces LDL cholesterol, the particles that are thought to link to heart disease. So the linkage between the diet, what you take in your diet, and what actually appears in your blood is a long, complex process. And to think that it's a one-for-one relationship, fat in the diet causes your cholesterol to go up, is ludicrous, because the cholesterol that is produced in the liver can be produced from carbohydrate. And when we put people on high carbohydrate diets, they produce more triglycerides, which are toxic, and they reduce the HDL cholesterol, the protective cholesterol goes down, and they produce the damaging cholesterol, the LDL small particles. So it is in the liver, under the exposure of insulin and carbohydrate, that the worst forms of cholesterol are made. It's not when the liver is under exposure to high-fat diets that you get these abnormal cholesterols formed. It's in exposure to a high carbohydrate diet.
Sê jy dus dat 'n hoë vet dieet nie cholesterol vlakke sal verhoog nie?
The large studies show that if you take enough people the cholesterol level, the total LDL cholesterol, will not change. But you have to understand that you have to measure it. Because when you get your LDL cholesterol reported from the laboratory, they don't actually measure it. When you're told what your cholesterol is, they use triglyceride and they deduct that value. Now, what the high-fat diet is, it lowers your triglycerides. So it must cause your LDL cholesterol to go up. It has to, because that's the way they calculate it. And no one ever tells you that. But when you actually measure the LDL cholesterol, you get one of three responses. Some people it goes up substantially, some people it stays normal, and many people it goes down. And so if you're worried about your high cholesterol, the first thing you should do is go on a high-fat diet, because you may drop it or it may stay the same. What the high-fat diet does, it raises your HDL cholesterol. So then if you measure total cholesterol, your HDL's gone up. Of course your total cholesterol's gone up. But people don't make that conclusion. The abnormal cholesterol that's going to kill you is large numbers of small, dense LDL particles. Those increase on a low-fat diet. So low-fat diet produces exactly the cholesterol molecules that kill you. Your HDL cholesterol goes down on a low-fat diet, and your triglycerides go up. And then there is other triglyceride remnant particles. So all four factors that are linked to dyslipidemia are all caused by high carbohydrate diets and are all reversed by high fat diets. Unfortunately, if you focus just on cholesterol, you miss completely all the beneficial effects in responding to a high fat diet.
Kan jy verduidelik presies wat gebeur as 'n bloedvat begin om te verstop? En ook die rol van cholesterol in die proses en hoe dit tot 'n hartaanval lei.
The other theory that this model holds is that a clogged artery is dangerous. In fact, it's not. A clogged artery, if it's stable, all that happens is you grow arteries around the blockage, which then protect the heart muscle. What really kills you when you have a heart attack is that the blockage on the inside of the artery suddenly ruptures. And that activates a clotting process, and then there's a clot which completely obstructs the artery. And that can then induce a fatal heart attack by producing abnormal heart rhythms. Now, that can happen equally in an artery that is almost completely clogged and in an artery that has only a 10% obstruction. In other words, an artery that looks absolutely normal. And that's the problem, that process has got nothing to do with cholesterol as we measure it. It's got lots to do with inflammation and oxidized cholesterol, and an inflammatory response that is activated. And that inflammatory response is determined to a large extent by the fats that we eat in our diet. And the omega-6 polyunsaturated fats that we're told to eat are in fact crucial to that process. Whereas the fats that we get from nuts and from fish, which are full of omega-3s, reduce that effect. So no one knows exactly what triggers the clotting process. But it's clearly not just cholesterol. It's a much more complex phenomenon. And inflammation has a crucial role to play. And so if you have heart disease, the key is you must reduce inflammation in the bloodstream. And you must do that by looking at what you're eating. And eating a high carbohydrate diet that brings down your total cholesterol will have no effect if it doesn't make your blood less inflamed and protect against these sudden clots appearing. If you are completely insulin sensitive, I will not advise you what to eat. You can make your choices. But if with age you find that you're putting on weight, you're finding it difficult to control weight as I did, even though I was running all this time, and I was always hungry and food controlled my life. That was it. You're always worried where you're going to eat next, and then you become ravenously hungry, and I would binge eat and I would eat lots of sugar. And that's the type of person who's insulin resistant, and they really benefit by cutting the carbs way down. If you don't have any of those symptoms, you have a fantastic relationship with food, and you can eat once every 8 hours or 6 hours, and you don't have to snack all the time between, then you know you're probably eating the right carbohydrates for yourself. But I just don't see that. I see children and adults eating high cereal grain breakfasts, and 3 hours later they're ravished and they're looking for foods, and 3 hours later they're eating again. And what are the foods they eat? They eat high carbohydrate, high sugar, processed foods, which are full of stuff that we don't even know what it's doing to our bodies, and it's not going to be healthy in the long term.
Baie dankie aan professor Tim Noakes. In volgende week se program sit ons die gesprek met professor Noakes voort, omdat daar nog baie inligting is wat hy met my gedeel het wat ek ook met al die luisteraars wil deel. Tot volgende week dan, totsiens.